here, but I guess we'll have to wait till Friday.
Well, she signed up against also, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, trust me, I will respond to the previous speaker. We're going to shift taxes around, we're going to shift them equally.
Apologize to the people.
I believe that what Mary's saying is gospel, folks.
I apologize to the people who wanted to deal with the TriMet issue that we couldn't get to your total concern this morning, but we'll give you another chance.
Are we not coming back this morning?
We're not coming back until 6:30 this evening. We're in recess. We have a number of bills that we want to get through tonight, and I'd like to take them in this order. House Bill 2248 first. As the members will recall, that's the one that had to do with enterprise zones and primarily a situation involving Northwest Portland, or North Portland, I guess. Then take 2594, which is an issue that deals with an insurance risk pool for small business. Then have the public hearing and possible work session on 541, deals with 911 districts, and then 275, and after that's done, we'll assess where we are. On 2248, there's an issue sheet that's been passed out to the members. The questions basically are on that sheet about how to deal with some of the outstanding issues in terms of defining time periods and conditions which would occur if the person who was promising to make an investment didn't actually make their investment. We also have Representative Carter with us, in whose district the major question that involved arises, and also Representative Carter is on the Trade and Economic Development Committee, who heard this bill earlier. I wonder, Representative Carter, do you want to say anything in particular about the bill, or do you just want to sit and work with us?
I came before you, Mr. Chairman, Margaret Carter, House District 18. I came before this committee because I'd like to urge your passage of House Bill 2248. My comments are that it would appear to me that at a time when we as Oregonians are facing economic woes, and especially looking at that whole area of property taxes and taxation as it relates to school financing, that we would try to encourage as much business, as many business opportunities in the state as we possibly can. The Nabisco situation certainly could be analyzed as one where many people might think you're giving a special preference to, and it does not make good public policy. Well, I say that when public policy has to be so limited that it discourages business from the state, then we're in trouble in terms of public policy itself. I urge your support of 2248, because it does two things, not only for the state, but for my district in particular. It played an important role in terms of retention, and that's something that we've not really addressed very much in this state. To me, retention is just as important as bringing new businesses to put new people back to work in this state. Both are equally as important. Nabisco Company has been at its present location for over 37 years. They've not had any modernization. In order to be competitive on the national model, on the national level, that we must be able to show that in Oregon we can compete to keep these kind of businesses here. Nabisco presently pay taxes in excess of $790,000 a year. For us as Oregonians to lose that kind of taxation would be a very sad commentary for us as a state, not just because it's in my district. To keep people on the jobs, and most of you know, after losing estimated that we lost about 79,000 family wage jobs in the state in the last 10 years, and all of those jobs that came back half as much in terms of the original cost that they were, the original price that they were paying. These jobs pay from $11 to $12 an hour. We do not need to lose that kind of revenue in this state. I urge your support of this bill and your concern for maintaining economic stability and economic quality in this state. And by doing so, I just don't think that you are prefacing one particular industry, nor are you giving preferential treatment to this one particular situation, but that you're making it possible for us as Oregonians to maintain a level of revenue that we need in this state, also to help pay school financing in this state. So I really urge each of you to think considerably moderate in your views in terms of this bill and support it.
Let me see if I get the logic of this thing straight. If Nabisco doesn't invest anything new, Oregon doesn't gain anything.
That's right. The possibility of losing.
We could lose something.
That's right.
If they invest something new and they pay their current level of taxes and we give them an exemption for some period of time, we haven't lost anything
in terms of
property taxes. And whenever that new investment goes on the tax rolls, then we have a net gain over time.
Right.
So I guess from the perspective after understanding this bill, I don't see how we can come out a loser unless they just decide to leave Oregon.
Right. Mr. Chairman, right? The other thing what I'd like to say is that right now they are paying $790,000. Now, if we were to give them, say, a four-year window so that they will have to have spent the $25 million in that period of time, their taxes are going to double, which means that Oregon wins. The other thing also that I don't know whether the person from Nabisco brought this to your attention, but in modernizing this plant that they presently have now, they also will have to build a warehouse, which is another phase of the program, and we're also in the possibility of trying to encourage a wholesale office, sales people office, to come to Oregon as well. So we will not only stabilize and win, but we will be doubly winning because they will have to build a new warehousing facility here, because they will become the major factor for producing for other states here on the West Coast, as well as sending products back to their East Coast facilities as well. So we not only gain a modernization and double tax and increase in taxation there, but we also increase our tax base by them also building a new warehouse facility.
Okay. Questions for Representative Carter, or should we go right into work session? Representative Jones?
I don't think it's fair to ask Representative Carter. I think maybe it's an issue of question of whether you really double the value by the modernization in terms of the taxes that you are paying. I think there's a question there in my mind as to whether you're really doubling the tax value because you've invested that money in capital in the plant itself. Right?
Mr. Chair, we're said in committee.
That maybe needs to be asked of some of our tax people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, it was said in committee last week when we heard this bill that as a result of modernizing, that their tax responsibility will increase twofold, double.
Okay, I think that the actual accurate statement would be if they removed old machinery, that would be off the tax rolls, because it's personal property that's being eliminated. Then that would be replaced by the new equipment. Now, how much of Nabisco's situation in terms of their total tax liability is in personal property, how much is in real property, how much of the new investment would replace existing equipment is something that we really can't guess here. But the point is, if they have $25 million assessed valuation today and they invest 25, it probably wouldn't be double. But if they invest 40, it probably would be double, I think, so that, you know, we're dealing in numbers in that range.
Mr. Chairman, our resident expert assessor is here, and who testified before our committee, mm-hmm. That could answer that question.
I think he had declined the opportunity to answer the question.
We're familiar with that gentleman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Okay,
and thank you, committee members, as well.
Why don't we go through the issue sheet? It looks to me like the questions that are really questions that we have to decide start under the third point, which have to do with dates in terms of how much time do we give them before they have to make a commitment. That's number A. And then number 3A, and then 3B is how much time between after they make their commitment do we think they should be given before they have to make the investment. The bill as drafted has a 2-year sunset date, but that doesn't really specify exactly, or does it? Steve, can you enlighten us on this one?
The existing sunset date in Section 3, July 1, 1989, repeals the Act. And in checking with counsel, I was told that in repealing the Act, that would repeal not only the firm from being qualified, but any property from exemption after that date.
So we need to modify that.
Right.
I think conceptually, though, we can deal with the issues as they're given to us on the sheet, which says, as the bill came to us, it was apparently the intent of the T&E committee to give them 2 years to make the commitment.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And so that I think if there's no other proposal from this committee, we'll go along with that intent. Representative Hugo?
What is the significance of a commitment date? Why is that a necessary element? Why not go to an investment expenditure date? Does the firm get a benefit by making a commitment?
No.
It seems to me the firm only gets a benefit by making an investment.
Well, I think it works this way, that, you know, that if you start making your investment as phased in, you're not going to probably do the first $25 million the whole first year, I wouldn't think. Do we know the answer to that? Or is it phased
part
in?
Part of the commitment, I think, is to make sure that some minimum amount is reached. Okay, that there is a commitment to do something that is not open. And some of the testimony dealt with this being a test case, so that you have some kind of period for that test case to occur in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jones?
I don't have any problem with putting a limit on the period of time in which this individual, this company, for test case purposes, but I think the question I have is, in terms of time frame, I don't know that it matters the commitment, at what point the commitment's made, other than when we, as a state, determine that we're willing to start forgiving some of the taxes. I think that's the question. Are we going to, we can give them a 2-year period in which to make the commitment, but I don't know that just because the commitment has been made, we would be ready to forgive the taxes. So I think the commitment is tied to what we want to do about that commitment.
Let me see if I got this right. The way I would just take the following scenario. Sometime between now and 1989, they say, we're going to invest $25 million, probably all just for ease of calculation, I'll say, we're going to invest $30 million in this plant. However, in the first year, they invest 5, in the second year, 10, the third year, 10, the last year, 5. So that might be a phased kind of investment program. We wouldn't know until after the third year of that that they'd actually invested $25 million. So you couldn't start exempting that first five out of the first year unless you had some idea that there was a commitment for the whole program. See, that's the answer to Representative Hugo's question, I think, is what's the value of a commitment? It would say if they're committed to the whole 30, then we could start exempting the first five additional investment in that first year. But if there were no commitment or no need for them to make representations, we wouldn't know whether or not that that ought to be exempted at all. So I guess in my mind, that's the reason for having a commitment, is because it's going to be a phased program sometime before they actually finish their full investment period. We might want to start giving some exemptions. They might want to start getting them also, I would suppose. Mr. Solomon, anybody, is that the idea here? Because we didn't have the benefit of all the testimony that Ways and Means heard about this issue.
Mr. Chair,
T&E.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Norm Solomon. I'm with the Economic Development Department. Basically, what we could do here in this case is to tie it back into the existing statute. Steve and I talked about this yesterday afternoon, that if the firm fails after 3 years to meet this commitment, then it would have to pay additional taxes. What that means basically is if we take each of those separate years, $5 million, $10 million, $10 million, $5 million, if we take each of those separate years' investments and treat them separately, that the first year, $5 million invested would receive 100%, 80%, and so forth, up to that third year, and then if the firm is disqualified by failing to meet the commitment, then it would be obligated to pay back a percentage of those taxes. And that is already in statute, and what we would have to do is find language to tie it back into the statute.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Hamlin?
A couple of questions. I'm not sure if this is the point in the decision process, but I'll let you make that decision. If they're going to invest $25 million, let's say, doesn't that also mean that they're replacing existing equipment / property, and that therefore they will be removing taxable property from the roll that's being replaced?
That's one possibility, yes.
And therefore lowering the assessed value overall under those circumstances. Not only keeping the current level of assessed value, but removing currently taxable property by replacing it.
Mr. Chairman?
It could be, and Mr. Solomon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamlin, perhaps the answer to that is to rely on the testimony that was given by the firm seeking the legislation, and that is the intent was to increase their level of investment by $25 million. If we can incorporate into that to increase the assessed value of the property owned by the firm within the enterprise zone by $25 million, so that if they were to take out some existing tax base, that the obligation would be to increase their overall amount of property by $25 million, not merely replace some of what's in there. That's an approach. It's not something I'm endorsing, but it's an approach to achieve what...
Could you do that again?
The commitment, instead of merely investing $25 million, would be to increase the assessed value of the property by a certain figure.
That's a way of rewriting the law.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamlin.
Just a second and somewhat separate question. In looking at this, I'm just trying to think of how it would be that the qualifications, it appears, could all be met on some other investment. And maybe I'm picking a bad example, but at least of the size of it, were there adjacent property around the airport or airport property? Because that's public. or something similar where there was a planned or near to planned investment, would this law also apply there? How would one define definite possibility of something being closed or substantially curtailed, or the other criteria in that the exemption would be crucial to preventing curtailment or closure?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanlon, the Enterprise Zone boundary stops at Columbia Boulevard in the north-northeast Portland Enterprise Zone. Are you familiar with some property near the airport?
No, I wasn't. I was just hypothesizing.
Mr. Chairman.
Seems to me we can do a lot of hypothesizing. I wonder if we can get some progress on this by maybe doing a little mental experiment with ourselves, thinking that this committee is negotiating with Nabisco on behalf of the state of Oregon, saying, what kind of deal do we want to strike? What do we want them to do? What are we willing to do? And if we could focus our minds on that, maybe we could get some progress here. Representative Hugo?
Well, unless we're prepared to write Nabisco, the subsidiary of R.J. Reynolds, into this act, which I don't think we're ready to do, whatever we do is going to be subject to the kinds of questions Representative Hanlon just asked. It has nothing to do with Portland Airport. What it had to do with is a company is located on a 500-acre site and occupies 100 acres and has a long-term plan to expand that plant and comes under this act and says, without expansion, we're going to have to curtail our operations. Ergo, we qualify for property tax exemption if we invest $25 million on something that was planned years ago. And you're going to have to address that company, and that company won't be Nabisco. It's going to be somebody else in Medford or wherever the enterprise zones are. And I would love to be able to negotiate in this bill a contract with Nabisco, but it's a state law that we're messing around with. For example, $25 million investment in what? Trojan spends $100 million a year in maintenance. If they don't spend that $100 million a year, the NRC doesn't let them operate. Is that an investment that's necessary or they have to curtail and shut down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hugo, basically, there are set kinds of investment that qualify for the enterprise zone incentives. What this bill provides is whether a firm qualifies for those kinds of incentives. There are restrictions on the kinds of investment that would qualify. Basically, we're talking about a new building, a new wing or story onto an existing building, rehabilitation, remodeling, renovation. That also meets certain minimum criteria, pieces of machinery and equipment, and again, meeting certain kinds of basic criteria. And so, if we wanted to incorporate into the statute that these are things not required by a regulatory agency as a means of maintenance.
So, you're missing that point entirely.
Why don't we just say, what do we want to do with this? I mean, are there questions that we still need to ask? Or are there proposals that we're willing to make? And I feel like if we run the risk of opening up the whole enterprise zone issue, which is what we seem to be doing, we might as well wait for Senate Bill 545 to get to us and deal with that all at one time. Or if there's something we can say concretely here, if you commit to invest $25 million by such and such a date, we'll give you a break. If you don't invest it, we'll make you pay your back taxes plus interest and stop giving you any further breaks. I think that, unless I'm being oversimplified, it seems that those are the choices. or as Mr. Solomon suggests, if you're willing to commit to increasing the true cash value of your property by at least $25 million, we'll give you a break.
At which point the assessor reassesses the value of property over time down.
Yeah, over some time period. And we can sit here and come up with a time period. Jim?
I thought maybe it would help if we sort of explain why we laid the sheet out the way we did and what went into that. Steve and I and Michelle from the Trade Committee basically put this together on the board and then copied it down. And I think on number three, which is, I think, the thing you sort of started with here, the commitment date versus the investment expenditure date, in the particular situation we're talking about, and I haven't heard anybody say this yet, and I wasn't here for the whole thing this morning, but my belief is that they're talking about a minimum investment of 25, but it could be as high as $85 million, depending upon what NIVISCA wants to do with that property. So that there was some feeling on the part of the Trade Committee that they wanted a very short timeline for this particular kind of legislation. They wanted a very short sunset date on it. So they had a repealer clause and a commitment date that was relatively short. But to make something, they wanted to allow them to come in with investment as high as $85 million, if that's what they wanted to do. They needed more time. You need more time to see whether they're actually going to do that. So there's a difference between the commitment date and the investment expenditure date. There was an interest in keeping this whole idea on a short leash, but realizing that it may take longer for the actual investment to come in. So it created a distinction in those 2 days. Now they did it not quite artfully, because they really didn't talk about it in terms of commitment date. They talked about it in terms of an investment expenditure date. They only really talked about the commitment date and then repealed the act and figured they'd be okay. But now you have looked at it maybe in a little bit more practical sense, and not realizing that you have to have those 2 days. So the first thing you need to determine is, right, you want the 2 year, I think it's 2 years to commit, it's in the bill. If that's fine, then how long are you going to give them to actually come in with that amount of expenditure? Or if the commitment is to just commit to at least 25, if that's what they're going to commit to, doing at least 25, how long do you want to let them come in with whatever they're finally going to do? They maybe within 4 years they'll do 65. They still maybe want to do some more, but they don't get it within the 4 years that you give them. So that extra 20 you'll have to come back for, or they'll have to do it on their own hook. So how long are you going to give them to come in with whatever they eventually do? Then the second question is, what do the firm commit to? And I think the chair is sort of leaning to the A approach, which is to say, we're just commit to do at least 25, and then your final exemption will be determined by what you actually finally do before the final date. You could go the other way of having them say, well, we're going to do 85, and that limits the amount they'll ever get. Two possible ways of doing it. Then five are the penalty provisions. If you go the way the chair suggests, that they just commit to doing at least 25, then the penalty provision we put, well, if you don't do at least 25, that what happens is that you just go back as if you never got the exemption at all. You pay back everything, including interest, as if you never committed. Because if you didn't commit to 25 in the first place, if you just committed to 20, you would have never got it in the first place. So if you only do 20, you just go back to what you would have had if you just hadn't committed to 20 in the first place. In other words, not going to pay everything back. But if you go the 4B way, then you've got problems in trying to figure out, well, they committed to 60, but they really only had to commit to 25, so you don't want to make them pay everything back. How do you figure out what they really have to pay back? So it's a little more complicated, and that's why it's a little more complicated there. That's the thinking that went behind that sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to follow that pattern, I mean, it's up to you. If you want to follow this sort of roadmap, that's the thinking that was behind it.
Sure.
Representative Hugo?
Jim, are you paying enough to send a 545 to be able to give us an overview of that bill?
not in 5 minutes.
Is it essential to this?
Is this discussion separate? Should this discussion be held separate from Senate Bill
545? Well, in a way it should, and the way it should. I think it helps to understand 545. And what we put up here maybe is the most important thing under number one. If you do this bill, it isn't going to work without 545 passing. Because 545, the kind of investments they're talking about there are not things that would be eligible, generally the way I understand it, without 545. In other words, the existing law only deals with new construction, basically, and renovations and basically expansions. And they're not talking about that here. They're talking about things that are not going to be eligible investments unless 545 passes. And so, to some extent, it does depend on that. But 2245, 48 can't really do anything without 545. 545 can do things without 2248. this one depends on the other doesn't depend on this. And it helps to understand the whole system, I think, obviously, before you try to understand the little growth that we're putting on it. But other than that, it can stand on its own.
Why did they send us 2248 to the House Revenue Committee and 545 to the Senate Revenue Committee?
I think the reason is that they had a Senate bill and they had a House bill. They already had everything in Senate Bill 545. They didn't have another Senate bill to stick anything into. I don't think they really thought about it. They're a joint committee. They don't think about it. Problems of committees that are not joint. I think it's basically the answer. The other thing is the number two here is the effect of this bill is to exempt these firms from the requirement in 545 that they have to have employment increases. That's really the effect of this. It says, You don't have to have the employment increase that 545 would require. Instead, you have to have what's in here. So that's how it relates to 545.
Mr. Chair?
Well, I think that, first of all, I'm going to place an amendment to the committee rules tomorrow that is the equivalent of a dumping fee for every committee that sends us a bill with loose ends in it. And I will say, if you send a bill to revenue with loose ends in it and you voted yes, then you commit to one vote at the discretion of the revenue committee. So that might deter people from sending.